with palm branches in their hands and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, "Amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Woo. So that was just this itty-bitty little tiny foretaste of what it will be like when Jesus appears. Just this tiniest little taste, which is glorious to me. I love it. So I apparently have some stuff in my throat. My apologies in advance for loud, ear-splitting, throat-clearing. So we're going to work on the subject, I hit the button twice, of the way of Christ and the apostles. Last week, Michael talked to us about rooting the paradigm deeply. I think, though, that there's at least a risk that when we use this phrase, it is not entirely clear what we mean. The trouble is that this phrase, the way of Christ and the apostles, is a type of jargon, and that's not bad. Every organization develops little verbal shorthands that they use. Is that for me? Oh, thank you. Every organization will develop little verbal shorthand things to indicate large, complex ideas like the way of Christ and his apostles, or like the paradigm, or whatever it is that you're talking about, the Paul-Timothy model, etc. Jargon's not bad, because what you can do with jargon is create a whole universe of meaning inside somebody's head by saying just a few words. Except the problem is, if the other person doesn't know what you're talking about, and they hear your jargon, they won't really understand what you're saying. It might create in their mind the wrong stuff. And so we need to, I think that it would be helpful, at least at the beginning here, to explain what we're getting at, what this phrase means. Regrettably, though, to do that, we have to unpack a second piece of jargon. And again, jargon's not bad. It's useful. But we have to unpack a second piece, which is the term secondary traditions, before we can even get to understanding what we mean by the way of Christ and the apostles. What is a secondary tradition? A secondary tradition is a tradition of theology, a set of ideas and beliefs and doctrines and behaviors and practices and organizations and whatnot, developed by a specific group of people at a specific time in a specific place. And I use the word specific specifically because it addresses a situation, a particular situation, a situation on the ground that needs addressing. A secondary tradition is an attempt to understand and apply biblical principles in a particular setting. Except the trouble is at least threefold with a secondary tradition. Number one, you could misunderstand the biblical principles, in which case your secondary tradition is flawed. Or you could misapply the biblical principles, in which case your secondary tradition is flawed. Or you could take the secondary tradition that was meant for this situation right here and pick it up and walk over to another time and place and set it down right there, and what you'll find is that it doesn't fit quite right because it was never designed for that situation over there. It was supposed to be over here. So when we talk about secondary traditions, we're talking about large-scale ways of thinking about the Christian faith. The thing is, though, secondary traditions are not the same as the biblical principles they're based on. They're not the same thing. If what you want, so a theological tradition is an attempt to understand the biblical principles and apply them in our own setting. Like you begin with a, if you want a painting of the sunset, say you live on the coast of Maine and it's just gorgeous, the sun sets and fall, and you want a painting of that. You do not go to a gallery and set up your easel next to a painting of a sunset and paint your painting based on that painting. You go outside and you paint a dang old picture of the sunset. Because the problem is the painting of the thing is not the same as the thing itself. The secondary tradition is not the same as the word of faith, the message contained and taught by the Bible. Those are not the same thing. And we as humans, we tend to get really confused on this point, such that we can't distinguish. We think that a theological tradition is just identically the same as the thing itself, just identically the same as the biblical principles themselves. But our charge as believers is to apply the word of faith afresh in every culture, at every time, in every different human society. And that's going to mean that we have a responsibility to go back to the biblical texts, make a new attempt to understand what they're saying, and apply them in our own culture. But oftentimes, we get so bound up in our allegiance to secondary traditions that we are no longer able to pull our eyes away from that and look back at the biblical texts. And then we go wrong. So I want to give you a couple examples of that. There's a book that's really influenced my thinking. It's called The King Jesus Gospel by Scott McKnight. And in it, he says, the typical way that we use to express what the gospel is something like, Jesus saved me from my sins. Jesus died to save me from my sins. And there's an element of that that's true. But when you read a passage like Acts 13, where Paul is preaching the gospel in Pisidian Antioch, he does not say anything like, we are here and God is over there and we're separated from God by a gulf of distance that sins have opened up and nothing that we do through our own efforts can get us across the gap, but the cross of Christ provides a bridge. Nothing like that do you see in Acts 13. Nothing. McKnight calls that the soterian gospel. It comes from the reformers doing something good, which is thinking very hard about the mechanisms of salvation, but then mistaking their hard, deep thinking on the mechanisms for salvation with the gospel itself. If you've gone through our story course, then you know that the gospel that was preached by the apostles is something like this. In the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus, the story of Israel to be redemptive toward all the nations of the earth reaches its fulfillment. Woo! That's the gospel if you read Paul or Peter or you read the gospels themselves. But our secondary traditions lead us down pit channels that are maybe not accurate. Another example, when we talk a lot about leadership in our church and in our network of churches. And that is good because leaders are vital to the health of churches. But the way that we talk about leadership is very different than the way other churches and other networks and other traditions do that. We have elders and deacons, and some other churches have elders and deacons, but we also have apostolic teams and modality spheres and sodality spheres, and we talk about the more mature and the less mature and the responsibility of every believer to be in the ministry. And I am not a pastor. We don't have ministers, and we certainly would not use terms like the clergy or the laity because we're not in that type of secondary tradition. But when people look from that tradition into our situation, it just looks weird to them. So what we are trying to do with the way of Christ and his apostles, with the paradigm, we'll talk about recovering this and recovering that. Really what we're talking about is clearing away the layers of theological reflection that have been accumulating and sort of try and brush that off like an archaeologist and say, yes, but okay, well, but what does the text say? What really is the teaching that that these documents is trying to put forth? And how do I understand that? And in the light of that, how are we as leaders in this church and as leaders in the network, and as leaders nationally and globally, how are we going to build structures and systems? How are we going to lead? How are we going to shepherd in light of that stuff? Clearing away the secondary traditions and building afresh based on a new understanding of the thing itself, the word of faith, the thing that the Bible is trying to get across. That's what we're trying to do here. So I want you to take a first period of discussion here to talk about that idea. Anybody can use the term the way of Christ and his apostles. That is what, see, and I did this on purpose because first we start with the idea that what we're doing is clearing away secondary tradition and trying to re-examine the New Testament text and build afresh. Then we name that attempt the way of Christ and his apostles. Then we abbreviate the attempt. See, it just keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, which is okay unless you don't know what we're talking about. So I'd like you to talk about how well you actually really do understand this thing. If you had to make an attempt to articulate it, could you? So try it. See if you can, at your table, see if you can get, see how full an articulation of you, of the way of Christ and his apostles you can actually get. And then, and this is where we're going to start drawing some threads together when we come back, I wonder if you could do a little reflection on how well you think you're doing at implementing that stuff. We don't just want to hear truth and go, oh yes, that's interesting, and then just go back to what we were doing before. An encounter with the truth, especially God's truth, should change us and shape us. And so are we actually doing this stuff? So do that for maybe until 10 a.m. and then we'll move along. But not enough to not do it, so sorry. All right, so the way of Christ and the apostles. What we're talking about here is an attempt to clear away secondary tradition, re-examine the New Testament witness afresh, and come up with articulations of the meaning of the New Testament and build our theological tradition again in a fresh and a new way. But I perceive a danger because we're saying something like, okay, you churches, you cannot build on secondary traditions indefinitely and expect to have the kind of fruitful ministry that you see in the pages of the New Testament. If you just keep, let's like, probably, I might be like right on the median. Half the people are going to understand this analogy, half aren't. I used to, when I was young, I would tape songs that I liked off the radio on my boombox. Now there's Spotify, so if this analogy doesn't work for you, sorry. But I'd tape the song off the radio, and you'd always get a little bit of an ad at the end. And then I'd want to make my mixtapes. Again, if you're young, ask somebody old. So I'd make my mixtape, and then you're recording another recording. And then I'd like take my mixtape and want to copy that and give it out to a bunch of people. Now we're talking about a recording or recording of a recording. And it just starts to decay. It does not sound as good as it would if you had just listened to the song on the radio. If you take a secondary theological tradition and you uproot it from this situation that it's addressing and plunk it down here, and these people all build off of it, and then you pluck it up from here and you take it over here and you plunk it down and all these people build up off of it, eventually you can't even really see the stuff underneath of it anymore. And that's kind of what we're saying, and that's kind of a bold thing to be saying. To say, look, you churches, you cannot infinitely build on secondary traditions and expect to have lasting, fruitful ministry. We're saying, look, you know, what you need to do is examine theology afresh in every generation such that you build in a way that is that brings the gospel message, the good news of Jesus, to your culture in the most powerful, impactful way as possible. That's what we're saying. And really, if you just sort of get down to the nut of it, we're saying, look, we understand some things, and our perception is that not everybody understands those things, and our desire is that other people would understand those things because it's had a giant impact on us, and we'd like it to have a giant impact on you too. And the risk that I perceive is that we'll go, woo! We've got the way of Christ and the apostles. And then you confuse the knowing with the doing. You wind up thinking, this is a temptation that I am particularly prone to, you wind up thinking that just because you know the thing, that's the point, and that's not really the point. So I have my discipline of reading through the full text of the New Testament. This is not like a thing that I do alone, but it's really paid tremendous dividends for me. Read the entire text of the Bible once per year. It's really, really fruitful in my life. And recently I read James. And James is a weird little book. It's a very badly misunderstood book. It looks like it's saying some heretical things. In fact, so much so that Martin Luther called it an epistle of straw and proposed removing it from the Bible entirely. Why would he do that? Because when he read James, he said to himself, this contradicts the doctrine of sola fide and sola gratia. And because this contradicts my secondary tradition of theology, I'm going to kick it out of the Bible altogether, which just goes to show how powerful secondary traditions can be. He wanted to start cutting up the Bible. Well, James is a letter written to Jewish churches that is meant to help them think effectively about how to live out their faith. And it's a Jewish Christian faith, and that's fine, provided that it doesn't do the weird things that Paul is warning about in Galatians and Corinthians, but to live out their faith in their own context under the difficulty of suffering that they were going through. And James says, and this is the bit that's relevant to us this morning, I'm sort of drawing several threads together, be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Because if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man looking at his own face in the mirror. For he looks at himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But the one who looks intently into the perfect law of freedom and perseveres in it is not a forgetful hearer, but one who does good works. This person will be blessed in what he does. So this bit right here at the bottom, this good works thing, this is the beginning of the appearance of contradiction within the New Testament. The appearance that, oh, this is against sola fide. Well, James is not saying your works will save you. This is not about mechanisms of salvation. James is drawing a contradiction between people who say they have faith, in scare quotes, they have faith, and it has no effect on their life whatsoever. Because he would say, I'm very confident, he would say you have faith, you don't. Because you look at the perfect law of freedom, and then you just walk away, and it's like you forgot everything. I mean, if I look at the mirror, if I'm out to dinner with friends, and I go in the bathroom and look in the mirror, and I've got like spinach stuck in my teeth, I get it out of there. If I look into the perfect law of freedom, here's how it should work. I should look at it, and then I should hold myself up next to it, and I should say, where do I not match this, and then make changes? Because if I just ignore it and go away and do nothing, I'm just a hearer of the word. And that's not really what faith is at all. Now, I am aware that there's a tension because I think that I would call myself a Protestant. I'm not a Catholic for sure, whatever that means. But I feel tension here myself. This idea of good works, this idea of responding, of doing good, of not being a hearer only. People will pit James against Paul. Well, you know, a few books before James is Romans, which if you're going through the Bible, you'll have read that recently when you read James. Check out Paul in Romans 2:13. He says, the hearers of the law are not righteous before God, but the doers of the law will be declared righteous. Same principle. Now, this is embedded in larger arguments, and I'm aware that I'm taking this out of the context of a larger argument, but it's the same principle. And in the larger context, the same principle applies. Don't be a hearer only. Be a hearer who does. Where would they get that nutty idea? Well, James and Romans are among the first documents of the New Testament, and you get more documents, and after a while, the churches got the Gospels, and they found out where James and Paul would get a nutty idea like that. From Jesus. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. Same principle. Merely hearing the word is worthless. Hearing and doing is the point. Holding ourselves up against the perfect law of freedom, evaluating ourselves, and responding appropriately. That's the point. And at the end of that magnificent document, the gospel, the gospels are the capstone documents. They were written toward the end of all the Christian documents. And so they sum up and gather together much of the teaching that the churches had received. At the very end of one of these, this one that we just quoted, it says, when the apostles are receiving their great commission, go therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age. But it does not say teaching them everything I've commanded you. I mean, Matthew could have written that. That is a possible sentence to construct. I can just say, baptizing them, etc., teaching them everything I've commanded you. That's not the point. It's teaching them to obey everything that I've commanded you is the point. Instruction comes with response to instruction. Hearing the word and believing the word ought to come along with response to the word. If not, then we're mere hearers. So what on earth does all of this have to do with the way of Christ and the apostles? What do hearing and doing have to do with what we are doing today? What does it mean in our context here in the city of Ames, with the Ames Des Moines City Church? What does it have to do with our national ministry, the Antioch Initiative and the City Church Network globally? What does all of this have to do with anything? Last week, Michael talked to us about the need to fully root the paradigm, that this is a work that we are doing, and especially in the second generation, we have a responsibility to make certain that we fully root the paradigm deeply down inside of us. Remember, the paradigm is another way of articulating this idea of clearing away the secondary tradition, getting down to the teaching of the New Testament, to the word of faith, the message that the Bible is getting across, and applying it in our own setting. So we want to fully root that paradigm. And he pointed us to four main components of that, namely local churches, church networks, apostolic teams, and the elders shepherding those local churches. In my mind, the way that I organize it is like this. Now, the expectation would be this. Everybody's head contains the same content, organized in a way that is the most memorable for you so that you can work with it the most effectively in your own head, provided that we're covering the same content. We don't just want you memorizing Michael's formula or memorizing my formula or memorizing Jeff's formula. Because if that were the case, then we're basically what we're doing is like the catechism where I say, or I ask a question and you give me the exact response that you memorize. So this is the way that my head organizes it. The way of Christ and his apostles is the kerygma, a response to which leads to an acceptance and a practicing of the didache, the practicing of which leads us to mastering the whole counsel of God. The way of Christ and his apostles is it contains modalities, local churches, the leaders who lead those churches and the work those churches do, sodality apostolic teams, the leaders of those teams and the work that they do. This is how my head organizes it. Our hope is that everybody would come to a deep understanding of the principles, of the content, and be able to put it together in your own head effectively, so that if you're asked, what is this way of Christ and the apostles thing you guys are always banging on about? You can just say it in a way that makes most sense to you. So what we want to be doing, Michael told us last week, is doing activities that will root that way of Christ and his apostles as deeply as possible at all levels. So if you are over there, where my son's a lot like me, right? If he has an audience, he knows exactly what to do with that. But if he doesn't, he's just kind of like, So he had trouble going into his Sunday school class. So in there, Jennifer Berg is teaching them about the story about how God called on Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. And I didn't catch the rest of the thing. But he's learning these stories. He's getting that story that the Bible is telling deeply rooted in him. And then at every level up from there, our expectation is that you'll be doing something. Something. Wherever you're at, whatever level of maturity you've advanced to, be doing something to advance to the next level of maturity. And specifically, if you are leading in the churches, and you know who you are, if you are leading in the churches, we want you to be engaged at a level of a formal Antioch school process. Minimum certificate of ministry. Minimum. And what does that mean? It's green check marks, baby. Yeah! Woo! Green check marks. What on earth is the point of the green check marks, though? I hate that this thing is advancing two slides every time I push the button because it keeps spoiling the ending, which is probably okay. So what do the green check marks represent? This is a misunderstood thing. I did a training for some people who'd heard Michael talk about the green check marks, and they wildly misunderstood what he was talking about. I mean, just massively misunderstood it. Because the way they interpreted that was something like, well, you don't really care about people learning and becoming effective in ministry. You just want them to get academic credit. That's not the point of the green check marks. You weren't listening. It's not academic credit. It's certainly not just like box checking, like I want the sheepskin to hang on the wall, so I'm going to get the dumb green check marks. That's not it either. The green check marks represent something. They represent a demonstration of competence. You don't have to do it this way. You don't have to do it exactly that way. There's a young lady who wrote a song to demonstrate competence in the theology, I believe it was the law, and wrote a piece of, you know, a text explaining how her song related to. She got credit because she demonstrated that she knew what she was talking about. So the question is not really, why are we insisting on green check marks? The question, the better question is, why are we insisting on a demonstration of competence in the ideas? Let's see if I can do just one slide. Yes. Because what we're going for is the equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry. I said earlier that one of the categories that we are not, that we're leaving behind as we clear away secondary tradition, one of the categories that we're leaving behind is clergy and laity. If you are a believer, you are in ministry. That is how it works. This is a type of ministry that I'm doing right now. There are so many other types of ministries. I mean, compassion and hospitality and leading and giving is a ministry. There are all types of things to do. Why do we want a demonstration of competency for our leaders? Because the demonstration of competency shows us, as the people who are leading at the level of the apostolic team, it shows us that this person knows what they're talking about. That they're able to organize. So this right here, this is a screenshot. Hey, this is Build Cloud 2.0. It's beautiful. It is amazing. I love it. So anyway, these are my green check marks in the Pauline epistles. What it does is it demonstrates to someone that I can articulate the ideas effectively, that I have determined the fundamental biblical principles for growing and strengthening a church to maturity and developed a strategy for implementing the biblical, etc. I know what I'm talking about. I'm competent in those ideas, which means that as I do ministry, I can be effective at it. But again, there's a danger here. I am the type of person who, and this is this, okay, so I can't even change my own motor oil, all right? I call Mark Bland anytime my computer does anything even slightly unusual. I have a very narrow skill set. My skill set is this: I'm really good at understanding complex ideas. That's my skill set. When you're good at understanding complex ideas, one of the ways that Satan will tempt you is arrogance. He will say, oh, you're so smart. And then the temptation is to think that just knowing the ideas is the point. Like, just mentally getting them into your head, that's the point. That is not the point. If I get the ideas into my head and do nothing with them, then I'm just a hearer of the word only. You believe that God is one, also James. You believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe that, and they tremble. So the demons know some truth too. Much good may it do them. The danger is that I take the ideas, I get them into my head, I look into the perfect law of freedom, and I go, ooh, pretty. You know, and that's it. The point is to look into the perfect law of freedom and then take myself next to it and say, okay, Paul says here, love your wife as yourself. How you doing at that, Caleb? Better at some times than others. It says, flee from youthful lusts. How you doing at that? It says, don't create quarrels and dissensions. It says all of these different things that I have to evaluate myself against, and to the extent that I'm not conforming to the perfect law of freedom, I got to change. Otherwise, I just have demon faith. That's not what we want. I want to be a hearer of the law who then changes and implements and does what the law says. Be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Because if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man looking at his own face in the mirror. For he looks at himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But the one who looks intently into the perfect law of freedom and perseveres in it is not a forgetful hearer, but one who does good works. This person will be blessed in what he does. So the danger that I perceive is that we, perceiving some things accurately, which I think that we do, and working hard to implement those things accurately, which I think that we do, will just get into this self-congratulatory, woo, self-high-five, fist bump mode where we forget that it's not about just knowing the stuff. Like, there is a real risk, and I say this not because I think we're doing anything bad, but because I think we're doing some things really well. There is a real risk that we would collapse into the sort of self-congratulatory posture that leads us to stop implementing. That's a risk for a team, for a second generation that is taking the baton and trying to run with it into the future. That is a real risk that we'll get into some kind of self-congratulatory mode and forget that we have to do this stuff. And we don't want to do that. And again, I'm not saying this because I think we're doing anything wrong. Daniel Brand, a partner of ours from Guatemala a couple of conferences ago, I don't even remember what the context of this was, but he said something that, man, just made an impact on my thinking. He said, oh, Caleb, Satan is patient. I said, what's that mean? He said, well, if Satan, see, you're wearing a suit of armor, and he's got a dagger, and if he takes that dagger and jams it into your chest and it bounces off because you've got that breastplate on, it's not like he's going to go, oh, well, and then just take his knife and go home. He's going to stab you in the neck, and if he can't get it in there, he's going to stab you in the thigh, and if he can't get it in there, he's going to stab you in the armpit. Ooh, chink in the armor. And then he's just going to drive the knife in again and again and again until you bleed out in the dirt, because that's how Satan works. So I believe that our ministry is doing some things, many things, really, really well. But Satan is patient, and I perceive a danger as we work to understand things that will stop at understanding, that will begin to get confused around what the point of the understanding is. The gospel calls us to a response of obedience. It just does. And truly throwing ourselves onto the gospel of Jesus means that we conform to its demands. Now, I don't think that that is as hard as some people think, because it's just the one thing. It's called discipleship Nachfolge in German. The cost of discipleship, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And he says, you know, how could Jesus possibly say my burden is easy, my yoke is light, my burden is easy, my yoke is light? How could he possibly say this? Because there's just the one thing, obey, that's it. There's not a thousand things, just the one thing, obey, that's it. Super simple, hard to carry off, very simple. That's what real following of Jesus, real faith in Jesus, faith in the Messiah of Israel looks like. It looks like hearing the word and being transformed and doing the word and not hearing only. So, second time of discussion here, you'll see that I've paired these questions of a purpose. Mastering the way of Christ and his apostles, implementing the way of Christ and his apostles. What do you not yet understand fully? What do you not yet implement fully? We draw a false dichotomy if we make the claim that understanding the way of Christ and his apostles and implementing the way of Christ and his apostles are separable. They are not. If we do not do, we prove that we do not know. So why don't you do this for, it's relatively early. Why don't you do that for a little while? And then, that was not my phone, just FYI. Why don't you do that for a little while? We'll come back and we'll pass the microphone around. So, what'd you think? When I first started leading midweek, it was, if you've never led a Socratic discussion before, you can't imagine how hard it is to figure out how that works. It's so hard. And by the end, when I first started leading midweek with Keith Cook, I was just rotten at it. And by the time we went from the midweek to the 12 churches, our group was so well tuned that I just go, so what'd you think? And this whole conversation would unfurl from there. So what'd you think? Tell me what your reactions were. This puts on notice the people who are in that midweek as potentially people that I might call on. Mark's looking over his shoulder. What stirred in your minds as you talked about that? One key to effective Socratic discussion is just let the silence linger until it gets awkward enough that somebody has to talk.
So at our table, one of the first things we talked about was mastering and what that really means. As you were saying, Caleb, it's not just understanding, but it's the implementation. So one and two go together quite well. That you can't, if you're not implementing, you're not mastering the principles. And like, I don't know, you think of any trade, if you have a master of a trade, it's not because they know a bunch of stuff. It's because they've had lots of years of experience doing that. And they've seen it all, so to speak, quote unquote. So mastering comes with dedicated time to understanding and doing the principles. And then the second couple questions there, we ended up talking a lot about motive for why are we trying to master? Why are we, the questions are, what are you doing to understand fully and, what are we not implementing fully? But it's like, why is this important in the first place? What's the ground behind that? I don't know if we came to a total conclusion on it at our table, but still wrestling with what is our motive for this? Is it, I know it's going to be different probably for everybody, but is it just to know? Is it because Christ, this is what the Bible says, or just to obey, or is there something else there that should be motivating us to really make sure that we have these mastered?
It's like an auction. Don't even scratch your nose.
So to answer a couple of those questions, I would say mostly. I wouldn't necessarily say entirely, but I wouldn't say not doing those things either. Mm-hmm. And the breakdown then becomes as an individual, as a father, as a leader of a church, those kinds of things. And so there's going to be some fragmentation inside of that. But I don't necessarily think you can, I think you can be doing more than you understand sometimes, and you can also be maybe knowing more things and then working out the process of, am I refining this? Am I still doing this the way that I'm supposed to be? Mm-hmm. I think there's room for that, because I think if we answer, we're doing this well, and stop, then what's the point of meeting and talking about this? So
now you are leading in one of our churches, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. You have taken up the challenge to become involved in a formal Antioch School program, is that right?
Right.
Okay, so what is the benefit of that to you?
The benefit of that to me has been just a deeper understanding of the ideas, and then being able to articulate those ideas in my own words, and then going through the process of having what I've learned be hopefully validated by others. So there's definitely been a growth inside that since I enrolled and since I started going through and trying to prove the competencies.
How has that work sort of landed in the ministry that you do?
Well, I think a big part of it for me then is passing that on to other people inside of the church, and more specifically, investing in a couple people, making sure that they are enrolled in that work and that they're getting their competencies done, or going to class and that kind of stuff. I mean, it doesn't do any good for me just to learn it and not be able to help pass it on to other people. Mm-hmm.
Have you found your ability to do the ministry sort of week to week changed or improved by that?
Yeah, tremendously, especially when bringing those other guys along.
Can you give an example of them? I know I'm putting you on the hot seat, so sorry.
Can I give an example?
Yeah, like how can you sort of illustrate tangibly the way that your ability to do ministry practically has improved by your engagement in the discipline of?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think just at a very broad level, just understanding the ideas a lot better. So when you have those conversations with people, mm-hmm. you know that you're, you know, on the right path when mm-hmm. you're passing that on to others, or you're helping others work through that, mm-hmm. you know, those ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good.
Hopefully that was the answer that you wanted, or I didn't want to.
Now we've got several people who are part of the Ames cohort. I'd be interested to hear. Now I know who you are, so I will shamelessly put some of you on the spot if I have to. I'm hoping that I don't. But I'd be interested to hear how some of the people from that group. So David is part of the group in Des Moines. I'd be interested to hear from the Ames group if there are ways that you've seen your ability to practically do ministry have improved as the result of doing that discipline with us in the Antioch School. Okay, so if you are a member of our first cohort, Ames Antioch School cohort, that would not be you. That's okay. You can be in cohort 3, man. I hope you will be. Become one of us, Luke. If you are part of that first cohort, so I'm thinking guys like Mark and James and Curtis and Joel and Ben, those guys, I'm wondering if they can give us an example of how their ability to do ministry has been improved or changed. Mark.
I feel like Caleb wants me to have the microphone.
I mean, James is right over there.
I've heard my name a lot, though.
That's okay, too.
So
love you, buddy.
The thing that comes to my mind is when we were going through the Pauline epistles, how it was around that time that I was moved into a spot where I was actually leading a church. Mm-hmm. Alongside a few other leaders, but I started thinking through, because I saw one of the things that the course teaches is how Paul was using those letters to establish the churches, mm-hmm. and I started to think differently about, okay, so here's the different things that Paul was teaching on. What of these things does our church need? And then which letters were the letters that Paul was using to emphasize and establish those churches in those things. Mm. And so then we started going through a couple of those letters at that time, because it's like, hey, this is something we need to grow at anyway. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing that really clicked in my mind, was just thinking how the letters were being used as establishing tools.
Mm-hmm. This is Pauline epistle stuff is what we're talking about. So the core four courses are the Acts, Pauline, Essentials, Leaders. That's tangible, on the ground application of the ideas. I wonder if you could comment on the table back here was talking about why we would do it. Can you speak to that?
Why?
Yeah.
So why study at that
level?
Wow,
why work for mastery?
I mean, I don't know how well this will translate across the board, but for me, it was kind of like, this is what I should be doing. Mm. As I grew in my faith, I realized I needed to have a greater understanding. As we moved to house churches, I saw, well, I need to have a greater role in this, because if we're going to continue to expand into other churches, eventually I'm going to be put into a leadership position, or at least I should be ready to step up if needed. Mm-hmm. And so I started engaging more at that point. And then the last why, this was probably 8 years ago now. Jeff did a message on Psalm 90 and had us all number our days. Yeah. And the thing that really clicked in my mind was not only my number, but the number of our leaders, which their number of days left was smaller than mine. and so I started to think, I only have this much longer with them. Mm-hmm. I should start gleaning what I can now, because mm-hmm. eventually I'll be in, you know, a position similar. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think I want to pin that before we wrap it up, because I wanted to describe to you a thing that I heard Steve Kemp say once. whenever somebody says, it's like Caleb said that one time, I have this like moment of panic. So wherever Steve is, he's probably having something similar to that. But he was leading us, Annie was pregnant with our first child, and he was leading us through parenting with a plan. And he said this thing that I heard that I thought, that's insane. And the longer I thought about it, the more mature I've gotten in my understanding and ministry, the more I think, oh man, that is so true. And he said the normal path of development should be into leadership. That should be the normal thing. Except people self-limit in varieties of ways. They check out of their own development. They disqualify themselves somehow. But the normal path of development and maturity should be into some form of responsibility in the churches. Because we don't want, as leaders, the thing that we want is not for you to like grow all at once immediately. That'd be great. Some people do that, but it's pretty rare. What we want is just a little bit of growth, a little bit of motion. Sometimes you'll go up pretty dramatically, but what we do not want is plateauing. And that tends to be what happens sometimes. This is me challenging you not to plateau. The normal development should be into some form of responsibility in the churches. Don't plateau. Continue your development. If you give yourself an out, then our churches will be weakened. We're the ones that have to be responsible for it. The church will not function if one person alone has to do everything. The church will only function well if we all take responsibility for it. So let's all commit ourselves or recommit ourselves to doing this process of development so that we can lead in our churches effectively. So let's pray, and then we'll end our time. Heavenly Father, thank you for the design that you have given to the church. Thank you for the flexibility of those principles to impact generation after generation in different times and different cultures, but that the principles of your word are the same eternally. God, I ask that you would give us seriousness about understanding those principles for the good of our churches, for the health and the salvation of our people, that you would give us seriousness about mastering and applying those principles so that your manifold wisdom would be made known. God, I ask that you would guard us and guide us, keep us from error, and lead us into truth for your name's sake. In Jesus' name, amen.